Welcome to Hot Yoga Radio. We're in the middle of nowhere, contemplating nature, Anna and myself, and we've all the honoured to have as our guest, Godfrey Devereux.
Devereux.
That's the correct pronunciation over there.
Tell me what my mother used to say,
it
rhymes with books.
There you go then. So, a scion of William of the Conqueror.
One of his bully boys.
So, anyway, what should we talk about, Godfrey? If anything, should we just look at things?
Well, we can. What did you want to ask me about? You wanted to ask me about something?
Resilience. You have been talking about.
Yeah.
This intrigued me. You said that you're no longer a yoga teacher.
Yes.
Even though I suspect a little bit of hyperbole there.
Well, a little bit of ducking and diving, smoke and mirrors.
Yeah.
Of course, I'm still teaching more or less the same techniques, practices.
Yeah.
But I'm contextualizing them differently in terms of what I'm saying about them, and I'm pointing them in a slightly different way rather than a different direction. So when I was a yoga teacher, I was 100% committed to yoga as self-inquiry, within which you don't know where you're going, you just find out when you get there.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no need for having intention or strategy or plan, you just tune in to what's already present.
Point
but now,
out.
With the resilience, the resilience focus has come because people, quite rightly, are getting worried about the state of the world.
Yeah.
Not just political, economic and social instability, but also rapid environmental, you could say transformation, but from our point of view, it's collapse.
Yeah.
And from the point of view of many, many species.
Indeed, yeah.
And people are worried about that, and a lot of people are, I would say, so worried about it that they don't even want to think about it.
Uh-huh.
So a lot of people are not talking about it, thinking about it, but they're anxious.
Yeah.
So the resilience thing is a response to that, and it's an internal response, in that it has nothing to say about what you could do to save the planet,
mm-hmm.
or what you could do to make your contribution to a green revolution or whatever. It's just to do with internal response based on accessing what I would call the natural resources within of human nature that most people have lost touch with because they're either busy struggling to survive, which is not the case for us or my clients or whatever you want to call them, they're not students, or struggling to succeed, to make their mark in the world and become somebody special.
Yeah.
So what makes it different from teaching yoga, which was always open-ended self-inquiry, is I know where I want to take them.
Yeah.
I want to take them in a very specific way into their own presence, into their own nature, so that they come out feeling safer, feeling supported.
Yeah.
And with a courage and a compassion and a generosity that naturally comes much more easily when you feel safe and supported than when you feel unsafe and isolated.
Yeah.
So that's the origin of it.
That sounds very coherent.
Yeah.
And
well, in a way, it feels like all of my journey as a yoga teacher was coming here. As you know, I was always a reluctant yoga teacher in the sense of being identified with the contemporary culture of yoga.
That's right, yeah.
So it's actually been a great relief to be able to say to myself and to others, well, actually, I'm not a yoga teacher, that this has got nothing to do with it. So in the past, I was in this game, it was a very fruitless game, really, of trying to explain to people why I wasn't teaching them how to become more flexible, more strong, more agile, or more perfectly aligned.
Yeah.
Now I don't have to say that. I say, look, if you want that, go do some yoga.
Yeah.
We're doing something else.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's not exactly self-inquiry. Yeah. It's more like self-awareness, just becoming aware of what is intrinsically present in all human beings, regardless of their social, historical circumstance.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm guiding them into that, rather than just leaving them on their own to find out what it is. And at the heart of it, really, is as I was saying before about support and safety and everything, is recognizing that, yes, we have this biological nature which is full of vulnerabilities, our need for everything, all of the nutrients, oxygen, safety, warmth and all that, but that we also have a spiritual nature which is not really separate from our biological nature, within which we have an inexhaustible invulnerability.
Well, it does make sense. It fits together, and I'm kind of sympathetic to the idea that of a practical use, even though I'm sort of one of those people that have said that we're not doing yoga instrumentally for an outcome, as I believe you're in that camp as well.
I was.
You know, even though I would say to people, there are spin-offs, you know, but that's what they are, they're spin-offs. If you turn them into the object, you might kind of lose the plot.
Well, I think you do lose the main plot, even if the subsidiary plot is relatively fruitful.
Yeah.
And the thing about the main plot is it fertilises everything.
That's right, yeah. It is about uncovering might be the wrong word ever, about recognising what you've already got.
Yeah.
And that we can be incredibly resilient and resourceful and find that our intelligence is speedy.
And adequate.
And better than adequate, kind of miraculous in some strange ways, I do think we need that yoga resilience at this time. I've certainly been saying it to the yoga community for a long time. You know, there is a kind of an activism in the air, even though, of course, you're saying what you're doing with people is purely internal.
Yes.
You don't consider the question of how, maybe you might want to consider it or not.
Well, for me, how
does that get outside?
That's their business.
Yeah,
I get that. According to their circumstances, orientation.
I get that, yeah.
Of course,
there's a field of discourse there, isn't there, that anybody can intervene in if they want to. Whether that will be effective or not is another matter, you know.
Well, let me just say that for me, what I think makes it, what shall I say, on the one hand really potent, but also on the other hand maybe a little different from what most people are looking at, is that it's experiential and somatic.
Yeah.
So you end up with it being embodied.
Yeah.
So it's not just an idea, it's not just a belief system, it's not a philosophy, an ideology.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not based on hope or wishful thinking, it's based on direct experience, which
my
years of being a yoga, meditation and tantra teacher have allowed me to learn how to put people very quickly, very easily in touch with their deeper nature.
Yeah.
And so what I'm really offering now is a very simple way of understanding that you can access that somatically.
Yeah.
And the most simple way to do that is, poetically speaking, love your body. Be nice to your body.
Yeah.
Be sensitive to your body.
Yeah.
And then your body will open into that. But the process of being sensitive to your body, loving your body, will actually, in a sense, in a very real sense, will create perceptual, muscular and experiential pathways into your nature, which then your nature can flow back out through into your life.
Yeah.
So you don't have to have a strategy for applying anything.
No.
It just comes out naturally. And of course, people for millennia have been experiencing that with yoga. You do yoga and your behavior starts changing, your understanding starts changing without you doing that dogmatically. Yeah. So it's about the power of the body to, the way I see it, be a link between the mad creativity of the mind in its endless dissatisfaction and what I would call the spiritual intelligence of consciousness and its magical adequacy, as we were just saying.
Yeah.
So that's more or less the story.
Yeah.
It has various frequencies. That's what I like to call them. There are basically five trainings.
Yeah.
Four of which are not completely, but it's somatic. Of course, there always has to be a cognitive element of understanding what you're doing and the implications of what you're doing.
Yeah.
And the fifth one is purely cognitive.
Yeah.
And the first one I call embodied resilience.
Yeah.
Which is just embodying your deep emotions of love, of peace, of generosity. And engaged resilience is learning to really let that out into relationship. And then sexual resilience is about integrating your sexuality into all of that. It's not about sexual practice or sexual skills, but just acknowledging your sexual nature and how, if you're not in touch with it, then you're very vulnerable to its repressed and
exploitation.
And then the next one is emotional resilience, and this is a little bit different. This is about actually helping people to acknowledge whatever it is that they feel about what's coming. And then the fifth one is, I call radical resilience, and that's a cognitive process whereby I invite people to see by the movement of their own intelligence that they are totally supported by the whole universe. Not their dreams, perhaps, not their hopes, not their expectations, not their ambitions, but they themselves.
Yeah.
And always have been and always will be, so that the experience that people have of that is to, feel safe in the universe as a whole, even knowing that there's danger in this very moment and this place. So, and the thing about that kind of ties them all together is that they're all based on one very simple, you could call it psychological phenomenon, with which I know you're very familiar, which is the closing of the subject-object gap. Which, of course, is not something you can close, but it closes spontaneously if you let go enough. So it's all about that. It's about applying that process to the body, to stillness, to relationship, to your emotions, whatever. And sometimes I call that the middle way between repression of your feelings, your desires, and expression of your feelings and desires. We know that repression is pretty much always guaranteed to create problems. And we know that expression is only okay if you're expressing to people who have given you consent to express whatever it is. Which is often not the case. So the middle path is what I call the way of intimacy, where if you feel anger, you feel grief, you feel desire, instead of repressing it and distracting yourself with some ideological justification for why you shouldn't be feeling it, or dumping it on somebody, you just feel it. You just feel it as deeply as possible until the, going back to the technicality of it, the subject-object split dissolves into that intimacy, and then all of a sudden that momentum to express becomes a source of nourishment because it's been absorbed. So I would say that's more or less the nutshell of it. The delight of it is, of course, only to be experienced. But I've been a little surprised, perhaps. Well, I don't know if surprise is the word. I appreciate the fact that when I decided that I was going to stop teaching yoga, which was really in August, and that I was going to try to convert my existing commitments to teach yoga to teaching resilience, and and to make, well, ask everybody who's been hosting me if we could just do that into the future. Everybody pretty much said yes. And the people who turned up, some people would never have come to the yoga. They came explicitly for the resilience. Those who came because they know me and they wanted more, they were really happy. And it just seems to be a timely thing.
Yeah, working out. Practically. Cool.
And I'm happier, you know, because I always found this yoga, well, let's just say the multiple yoga ideologies dragging at me, you know, in so many different directions. And and now I can just say, you can just do that, whatever. I have nothing to do with that.
Well, that's really interesting. That's, and I like the way you put it together. It was occurring to me while you were talking about you were emphasising the somatic nature of the inquiry and the insight or the events, you know, that it is all, it's somatic, not purely theoretical. And it seems to me that getting into that way of doing inquiry, just any inquiry really, is it's analogous to overcoming, again, overcoming might not be the wrong word there, but the dissolving of the subject-object, the dissolving of the mind-body, the, you know, these dualities that like gum everything up, you know. And it probably is the same duality, really, ultimately.
In each case, yeah.
Yeah, it's yeah. a kind of a slavery to binarism, falling into sort of, I don't know, just binaries in order to think. And yeah. they form a big part of trying to kind of get to grips with things. There are oddly techniques, are there? Because it's all kind of straightforward and relatively simple, but whereby you can't.
It's just like walking, isn't it? You need two feet.
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
Left, right, yeah. Subject, object, self, yeah. other, yeah. inside, outside, yeah. left, yeah. right.
It's part of the toolkit and part of the endowment that you have as being a human being, yeah, but you can kind of get a bit wound up with it.
Yeah.
You know. And it's like you're talking like, oh, this is all very somatic, but you're not saying, from what I can see, you're not saying it's somatic and not ideological or mental or to do with the mind at all, you know.
But there's a cognitive element. There has to be, otherwise you don't know where you are. You don't learn anything.
That's right, yeah.
But the cognitive element is not driving it.
Yeah.
The cognitive element, of course, sets it up in the first place. Say, let's do this.
Yeah.
You know, but once the process has started, the purpose of the mind is to basically learn and enjoy it.
Yeah, of course, yeah. I'm all for that. Otherwise, being a lazy bugger myself.
Yeah, and the beauty of it is, when people come to learn, well, to, I don't know if they come to learn or find out about it,
yeah.
they come without any of those spiritual expectations that yeah. come that they bring yeah. to yoga, and so actually that means they can get it much faster because they don't have to wade yeah. through a load of stuff.
Yeah.
Because it is here already for them to experience.
That's
so
right,
why
yeah.
should it be so difficult
yeah.
to access? And of course you and I yeah. have known for a long time that it's not difficult to access.
No.
But it seems to be so much easier for people when they're yeah. when they're released from all of that
yeah.
stuff about
yeah.
well, it's about yeah. success and failure, isn't it?
Yeah.
Stopping the mind and not yeah. feeling desires and not feeling
yeah,
anger
all
and not
crap,
feeling
yeah.
attachment.
Yeah.
In other words, not being human, but...
Yeah, you know, it's just all the stories as well.
Yeah.
I mean, I certainly feel like an imperative to sidestep the stories of the yoga culture, particularly the contemporary yoga culture, you know, to... Who knows what it was like years ago?
you can't dispense with the deep roots of it, you know, yeah. because for me, this whole thing, I'm talking about the somatic and embodied, but yeah. actually for me, it's all about consciousness.
Yeah.
And we, yeah. in our contemporary European vocabulary, we just have that one word, and yeah. which is in Sanskrit, chitta, and we don't yeah. have chit.
Yeah.
And because of that, we kind of lost.
Yeah.
Because we don't have the bigger contextualization from which chitta originates.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking the popular culture, you know, I think Patanjali, from what I see, it's like, gives us a great vocabulary and some very fine distinctions.
Yeah,
they're pretty useful if you're gonna come at it from that angle.
As long as you don't misread the text as one subscribing some kind of form of behaviour,
yeah.
or even practice.
Yeah. Yeah. Indeed. Indeed.
Yes.
But we've got a whole load of like a popular culture that's remote from that, haven't we?
We have.
You know, it does no service to the insights of somebody like Patanjali. Because it's all about God knows what. But like, I think you're right. Some of the acquisitiveness and, you know, that you want to succeed. What was the other thing? You want to survive and you want to succeed, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, you have to survive.
We have to survive.
But who says you have to succeed?
No.
Why don't we then just celebrate?
Well, what does it even mean?
Yeah.
Really, you know.
But I don't see
anything wrong with having projects.
No, but let's celebrate. Use them to celebrate.
That's your energy expressing itself, yeah. isn't it?
This is a village, huh?
Yeah, there's a little group of farmhouses. I think it was going until just after World War II. And then it sort of fell into disrepair. I think they've cannibalised the roofs for the slate because there's very little slate hanging about. So, if you were to intervene in the discourse around...
External responses?
Well, around the situation, the emergency, you might say. where would you be? Or would you say, I wouldn't bother, I'll just, my job is tuning people into the resilience, and then if they're of that bent, they'll have a better toolkit for,
I think,
figuring out what they're going to do with it.
And,
is that where you want to stop, or do you have anything to say? Any intervention in the discourse that happens out there?
Not in a practical sense. Not in a practical
or
sense.
Or an organisational sense.
I just say go for it. Whatever you think you want to do, go for it.
Yeah.
But I would also say for people who don't know what to do, don't feel guilty. It's not going to help.
No, the guilt's no good. Yeah. No. I think it should... My conceptualisation of this, which I came out with at one of the psychedelicist things, was a carnival-esque revolution of love.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There you go.
But how hippie? How hippie? And you go and say that in the Labour Party meeting, and they kind of look, start snorting their tea down their nostrils, you know?
Well, you have to put it differently. And first of all, you have to give them some kind of experience.
Yeah.
That's how I see it. But I think that's exactly it. It's about, instead of struggling to succeed, let's just celebrate. You know, okay, maybe, what's the worst case scenario for human beings? Extinction. So let's say, maybe, but let's love our way there. Let's take care of each other there.
Yeah.
You know, let's celebrate what we are, what we've had, as you know, each one of us has had life for however long we've had it.
Yeah.
And we were always going to die too soon.
Yeah, of course. Well, my thought about this has been, perhaps over the ages, and I was saying it to the yoga wallahs, that, you know, when the shit's hitting the fan, people, it's your door, people are going to come and knock, actually.
Yes.
If you're a neighbourhood yoga teacher, some of them will whip off to the Methodist church or the mosque or whatever, but some will be, a lot of them will be knocking on your door and saying, what should we do?
Yeah.
Because you've kind of stood up as somebody who, rightly or wrongly, appears to know something. Yeah. Maybe you don't, you know.
And well, I think that's the point with it, when it comes to this.
And it's about care.
We don't know exactly,
of course not.
In the externals, we don't know exactly what or when.
No.
Or how.
But we know, I think, fairly unequivocally that there is all the major life-sustaining systems for humans are unstable.
Yeah.
And obviously they fluctuate. If you get one of those like feedback loops where they all kind of happen to peak at the same time, like the economy's going a bit tits up just when Greenland melts and you know or whatever you know,
yeah.
And you can get this bad synergy. And
listening to a presentation the other day by somebody in the alternative energy sector, who very succinctly, clearly explained how. The figures themselves about fuel sources and how they're used, all the idea that we can go green in time is just
it's a bit hopeful even though I've sort of come across that view, and I think it's and they're pretty smart people, but I think they you can also be a bit pessimistic. I mean, there are some kind of theoretical limits and equation type stuff around solar and so forth,
but renewable energy is at the moment producing 3%.
Yeah,
and it's got to produce 100%.
Yeah,
soon.
Yeah,
but things don't move that fast.
It's a very tall order. Yeah. Yeah, it is a tall order. I think it's like no reason not to though.
No, do what you can.
I actually think it's better in some ways than has been represented, because there's an enormous amount of money and energy goes into persuading us that it's a hoax, you know, or that it's nowhere near that we're being fed, at least an exaggeration. For instance, the Koch brothers, one of whom died this last year, have been putting enormous amounts of money in for decades into climate denial. And they actually funded one of these super PACs to get Trump elected. To an enormous amount of money, and to manipulate Facebook ads and all this kind of stuff using a database that's got 1,800 data points on 290 million American citizens. So they can target adverts from a portfolio of a million different ones. Oh yeah. To people. And this kind of swung the election, and the Koch brothers financed that. And the part of the deal was, we'll get you in, but you pull out of the Paris Accord.
Uh-huh.
You know, so there's all that going on. And I know some of the...
You mean if that stopped, things would all of a sudden be a lot better?
We'd be in a better position, yeah, to sort it. And I do think some of the scientific stuff... Obviously, I'm not a climate scientist, but I'm not scientifically illiterate either. I think there is a scientific pessimism. Yeah, that's my thought. I mean, the limit, it seems to be, with the alternative energy stuff is still storage.
Yeah.
Whoever comes up with a better battery, because lithium's not that plentiful, and you get the politics of mineral.
Yeah.
You get the politics of the curse of being resource based. Where's it? Bolivia. Bolivia's sitting on tons of
lithium.
Do you guess? And I think the biggest deposits, I guess, where? Afghanistan.
Are they?
Yeah. The actual lithium that's been used now is mined in Australia by Chinese companies. So you get all those problems, but there may be ways of overcoming that. There's an awful lot of energy in the world, you know. Millions of times more than humans, even as numerous as we are, actually need or could even use.
Yeah.
I mean, basically, look out there, you know. And why salt as duck? Do you know about salt as duck? It's a thing that you can just moor it out at sea and it bounces up and down in the sea and it generates electricity like that. It's by a bloke, Professor Salter, and it's like a duck on the sea. But they build them the size of a house or the size of a block of flats, and they produce kilowatts and kilowatts and
from
gigawatts.
The bounce.
Yeah, day in, day out, no problem about night. People say there's a problem about cables coming under the sea, but cables, electricity comes under the sea on cables all over the place. We import electricity from Iceland undersea cables. Yeah, so
really?
Yeah. But Mrs. Thatcher pulled it. I wonder who was leaning on her to pull it. Yeah. There's tons of stuff, and I think some of these science wallers saying that, oh, there's these intrinsic limits. I actually don't see it. You know, there's probably an upper limit to how much. You know, solar panels got more and more efficient. The photovoltaic cells got more and more efficient, but it's kind of hitting an upper limit now. And there probably is a theoretical limit on that, you know, with an equation and all the rest of it. But in terms of how much energy there is in the world, which ultimately comes from the sun, it's for our purposes unlimited almost.
Yeah, somebody gave me a figure the other day, actually. The energy from the sun is enough for so many hundred years or whatever.
Yeah.
For one day.
Yeah, I've seen these debates, you know, and I'm pessimistic about the politics, but yeah, not about the human ingenuity. Also, actually, we'd be perfectly happy doing with just far less of the crap, which kind of adds nothing. Even though I think people who are investigating what you're talking about do self-inquiry. You find that there's just loads of entertainment for free. Can I put it like that? You know that you. Do you know what I mean? A simple life can be incredibly rich.
Life is incredibly rich, isn't it? If it's voluntary, anyway.
Yeah. Obviously, you know, poverty forced on people, grinding poverty is another matter. I think I've got the idea, you know, of prosperity. I don't have a problem with the thought of prosperity, but you need to think how you're understanding that, perhaps.
Yeah, what is prosperity?
Yeah, but what is it, you know? Anyway, it's interesting what you're up to, and kind of be veering in a bit of a direction like that myself.
Have you seen my blog?
I haven't seen it now. Shall I have a look?
Seen it?
No, I didn't even know there was one.
You're asleep. It's godfreydeverix.com.
Okay.
It started April, and I've been.
What, you do it every day?
No,
once a week.
Once a month, once every 2 months, whatever. Yeah. It's not like your regular kind of blogger's blog.
Right. Yeah.
But I've been, well.
Is it written?
People have been pressing me for years to do one, and I was resisting, and then finally I did, and I had no idea. And then I wrote the first one, and then I just thought, this is going to be about the climate thing, the environmental thing.
Yeah.
So that's what it's turned out to be.
Yeah, I'll have a look. Definitely have a look. Anna wants to say something.
Look, you're getting can see Bardsey Island a bit clearer yeah. now, and the spleen's come out.
Yeah.
There it is on the end.
Yeah. Some light conditions. You can see actual individual houses, can't you?
Yeah.
On where? On the mainland over
on
there?
On the mainland over there,
oh, yeah.
yeah.
Amazing.
And then other times, it disappears entirely, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You could hardly see it yeah. this morning.
Yeah, it was like barely.
I'm not sure that's a bank of cloud there, but I think you can get a hint of Pembroke just if you look past the headland there.
Ah, yeah.
Yeah, that's the.
Yeah.
Which is a good distance. So, you kind of answered my question about intervening in the discourse, that you've got a blog that talks about about climate, so you kind of.
Yeah, I suppose if you call that intervention, I'm just saying it's coming. Yeah. Look within.
Yeah.
To be ready.
Yeah, well, that's more or less I've been saying that to people as well. Just doing those general yoga classes, neighbourhood yoga classes. Yeah. I'd say that every time.
Yeah. I went to a little festival in Denmark, you know, I was asked to go and speak. So if that's intervention, then that's what I would do. Yeah. And somebody just recently asked me if I would go and present the resilience thing at a Tantra festival in Sweden.
Yeah.
And I've been invited to the next Science and Non-Duality conference in Italy. And that's what I'm going to present.
Yeah, well, that's what you do. You talk, don't you? That's one of the things you do.
Well, but at the Science and Non-Duality thing, it's going to be two workshops, so it's going to be experiential.
Uh-huh.
And I'm going to give a little 10-15 minute talk beforehand about what it's all about.
Explain it. Yeah.
Barmer.
Well, I think thank you very much, Godfrey, for that. I will get this out on the airwaves. I like the way you put it together. Very precise and neat and cogent and coherent. All right, thank you very much. Over and out.